Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Edward Snowden's open letter published in the German magazine Der Spiegel, A Manifesto for the Truth, and get an analysis from a 27-year CIA veteran, Elizabeth Murray, who served as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East on the National Intelligence Council. We will discuss the Snowden letter written in Moscow on Friday, which accuses governments of trying to squash debate about mass surveillance with a never-before-seen witch hunt. Then we will revisit the deadly intersection of mental illness and easy access to assault weapons, which is the apparent reason behind the shooting at Los Angeles International Airport. John Donahue, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis, joins us to discuss the irony that the victim was a TSA screener who Americans accept as someone preventing a terrorist attack, however remote, but daily acts of gun violence that kill 2,000 times more Americans than terrorists are apparently acceptable as the NRA ensures no laws can be enacted to stop mentally ill people from purchasing military-style weapons. Then finally, we will speak with Jim Wild, president of the Food Research and Action Center, about the cruel and unusual cuts in food stamps assistance to over 47 million needy Americans, with three-quarters of the participants in households with children. We will discuss the political momentum against helping the least among us in the name of reducing the deficit, even though the deficit is receding at a record rate, and while food stamps are considered one of the most efficient ways to stimulate the economy, as every dollar in food stamps generates $1.70 in economic activity. And joining us now is Elizabeth Murray, who served as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East on the National Intelligence Council before retiring after a 27-year career in the U.S. government, where she specialized in Middle Eastern political and media analysis. She is a member of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity in Intelligence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Murray.
Hi, pleasure to be with you, Ian.
And Elizabeth, yesterday I spoke with Ray McGovern, who, as you know, went recently to Moscow and met with Edward Snowden along with other with a delegation of other veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity. And they presented Edward Snowden with the Sam Adams Award. And since you were with the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity Intelligence, I guess just for the benefit of the public, my recollection is that Sam Adams was the CIA analyst who alone stood up to the entire U.S. military during the Vietnam War and kept saying we were losing the war, and to the political authorities, while the Pentagon and General Westmoreland and were having the 5 o'clock follies every day, talking about body counts and light at the end of the tunnel. Is that the do I have that right?
Well, that's right, except that actually I think Sam was, like many people in government, he knew the truth, but I think he was afraid for his career. He was afraid to speak out and didn't actually begin speaking out until after he'd left the government, after the fact. And he actually really regretted that he hadn't spoken out sooner. He felt that he could have avoided maybe entirely one half of the Vietnam War Memorial names maybe wouldn't be on there. And he went to an early death with this regret. So I think that we want to honor Sam Adams' spirit and hope and reward, at least hope that others will be motivated to speak out while there is still time and before, you know, the consequences manifest themselves.
So did he speak out while he was in government or only, I mean, within the confines of government interagency discussions?
I think he tried at a very sort of basic level and was told that no, that was not on, that was not acceptable. And, you know, there were certain agendas that were going forward that prevented him from really speaking out more than he was able to. So I believe he did testify during the Pentagon Papers time, but by then it was too late.
So how does this apply to Edward Snowden? Because I had conflicting interviews on it yesterday with Ray McGovern basically saying that, you know, that Putin was in fact protecting Snowden and, you know, that from SEAL Team 6 or from drone attacks. And on the other hand, I had Lon Snowden's lawyer, Bruce Fine, who's also represented a lot of the people that were at the met with Snowden, Jeslin Radek, for example, in Moscow, and he was actually quite critical of WikiLeaks for gatecrashing. He felt they were gatecrashing and using the Snowden affair for publicity and fundraising, and also of Glenn Greenwald, who he thought was making movie deals and film deals, etc. So I'm trying to – and the main critique that he had was that the focus has been lost from Snowden's original speaking out about the domestic intelligence abuses, and but the focus entirely shifted to foreign intelligence. So is that where we are, and what is this manifesto that came out today in Der Spiegel going to do for us?
Well, I think the manifesto is pretty straightforward. I think Ed Snowden basically is saying, I have the right to privacy. I cannot guarantee that my government will uphold this privacy or any of my other rights to privacy that are being violated through this mass surveillance. Therefore, I need to take action. So, I mean, I think that there's this debate about is Ed Snowden a hero or a traitor. I think it's a gray area. Life isn't that simple. I think, obviously, he did overstep some legal bounds to do what he did, but I think that we all owe him thanks, because what he did was a much greater good. I mean, he's basically, in my view anyway, he is trying to improve the way this country protects its citizens' freedoms by calling attention to the abuses and invasive monitoring of the communications of American citizens, which, by the way, has been going on without public knowledge, without public debate, and evidently without any accountability by our policymakers. So I think Ed Snowden saw the need to shine light on this secret program that was targeting innocent Americans. And now, yes, it's up to us, the American people, to hold our policymakers accountable for this.
So do you think that given the shift in focus, at least in the press, where there's this constant drip of new revelations about NSA spying on the Brazilians and on the French and on the Germans, on Angela Merkel, you know, what sandwiches she orders and this kind of stuff, and that what is happening, as far as I know, in terms of efforts to reform, particularly the NSA's behavior here in the United States, are they getting lost a little with all this focus on foreign intelligence? I mean, you've got people like Dianne Feinstein constantly talking about the need to stop spying on foreign officials, but I don't hear a lot of talk about, because as you know, there was a very close vote in the House a while back to basically strike down the rubric under which the FISA court uses the Patriot Act to gather all this metadata that Edward Snowden exposed.
Right. I don't know whether it's actually distracting, because I think the whole thing needs to be taken sort of holistically. You know, some people might think it's okay to bug Angela Merkel's handy, and, you know, maybe there might have been a small window for that, you know, right after 9/11 when people were concerned about, you know, well, who's on our side and what's going on. But, you know, a lot of this bugging is of, you know, United Nations, of actually, you know, economic targets. I understand Brazil's Ministry of Mine and Energy was bugged. I mean, a lot of this we need to, you know, take on board here in the United States and think to ourselves, okay, if this is what's happening abroad, you know, if it's not already happening here, what is the potential for it to happen here? So I think we need to take lessons from this information and apply it to, you know, what kind of abuses are going on here with our own privacy. So I don't really think it's something, it's something that's unnecessary or too much information. I think it's something that it's still an important window into what the NSA is doing and what the NSA is doing beyond its mandate.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Murray, who served as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East on the National Intelligence Council before retiring after a 27-year career in the U.S. government, where she specialized in Middle Eastern political and media analysis. She is a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity in Intelligence. So is it a result? In fact, frankly, when the story first broke, one of the more important aspects of or perhaps tangential aspects of the story was that Edward Snowden was working for this defense contractor, Booz Allen Hamilton, who are in turn owned by the Carlyle Group, and that they get 98% of their income from the federal government. And they these contractors basically hoover up about 70% of the intelligence budget. And my understanding from talking to former CIA officers is that there's a great deal of resentment within the public service that they're being poached. The intelligence professionals are being poached for their security clearances into these contractors' operations where they, as in Snowden's case, their pay is tripled or quadrupled. But then the government, then the contractor charges the government, you know, they mark it up about tenfold. And the long and the short of it is that is this resulting in a focus on economic intelligence, which I understand is what's the subtext in the anger that the French and the Germans have, is that these private contractors like Booz Allen Hamilton are not necessarily interested in traditional national security, but more interested in economic intelligence because that's what they are, private corporations.
You know, I really hesitate to tread into that area, which I don't know enough about. I would prefer not to speculate.
Mm-hmm. But it's a fact, is it not, that within the intelligence world, there is a lot of, in effect, people are trading in public service for private gain, and this is this having a deleterious effect on the what's left of the traditional intelligence, which is the you know those that are in government service as opposed to those making a living off government service.
Well, to my knowledge, I mean, even if someone is a contractor, they're still under the purview of a government supervisor. So presumably, you know, the government would still be the one that is driving the intelligence. You know, I will say that during my time in government, there was a bit of resentment against the so-called, you know, green badgers, vis-a-vis the blue badges, which were the government people, because, of course, yes, they often did make more money than us, and many government people did sort of go over to the other side, if you will. But at the same time, you know, there were sort of less benefits, and I'm not sure the retirement was the same and that sort of thing. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether it's more profitable to be a contractor, especially if you don't know from year to year whether your contract will be renewed. But in terms of Booz Allen or another contractor driving the intelligence agenda, that I wouldn't be familiar with.
Well, one of the people that went to Moscow, I invited him out here recently to the UCLA Hammer Forum that I do in Los Angeles, and he, Thomas Drake, and he was a genuine whistleblower, as much as he didn't take any documents with him when he left the NSA. And they, in fact, they tried to nail him by reclassifying a document that he had at home to as an excuse to put him behind bars because he was blowing a whistle on a massively expensive boondoggle called Trailblazer. But he had told me that during that period when he was when he left, the 2001 to 2005 period in the first Bush administration, there was absolutely no restraints on the NSA. And have we retroactively, I mean, I know Snowden has opened the door a little bit, But are you satisfied that we are even anywhere near knowing the full scope of what the government's been up to in terms of its surveillance on American citizens? Because apparently through that early period, 2001, 2005, they weren't even going via the FISA court.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. Obviously, this has been going on for some time. I guess that remains to be seen. You know, with it, as you say, this drip, I don't think there's going to be any let up in terms of the revelations that come out. But perhaps someday we will find out. You know, it's my hope that as a result of what Ed Snowden has initiated, you know, that our government will undertake some reforms. And, you know, maybe the American public will, you know, learn what it deserves to learn about violations of individual people's freedoms. I mean, these, you know, we're talking about, you know, innocent people whose communications, whose emails are being, you know, monitored or have been monitored for a prolonged period of time. So I would hope that these things come to light. And, you know, I might add that, you know, if the U.S. government is interested in preempting future Mannings and Snowdens and future whistleblowers, then I think it's the obligation of this government to be very straightforward and upfront with the American public, even when it comes to sort of embarrassing transgressions. I think it's far better for the government to come clean than to have these individuals come out. But again, I mean, I think if people see that there's no other recourse. Nobody wants to go through what Tom Drake went through or what Bradley Manning went through.
Well, should there be then one of the reforms, should it not be some kind of internal forum that's stronger than the Inspector General regime, which doesn't seem to be particularly effective? In other words, had Sam Adams had a forum where he could, expound on his concerns about U.S. foreign policy based upon bad data, as the Vietnam War was, and in the case of Snowden, he wouldn't have to go off to both to China and Russia, which are hardly friendly to the United States and hardly are paragons of civil liberties. So, is there a way to construct something, a place to go that's stronger than the Inspector General regime with people inside who have serious concerns about what the government's up to?
Well, I would have thought people could either, you know, failing the Inspector Generals, which unfortunately is often the fox guarding the hen house, because in the CIA, for example, the Inspector General, you know, comes under the purview of the Director of Central Intelligence. And so, you know, we already know what happened there. When one Inspector General, tried to release important information about CIA transgressions in Guantanamo and in Abu Ghraib and elsewhere, the then director of CIA, Michael Hayden, had the Inspector General's office itself put under investigation. So, you know, but what about the Senate, Oversight Committee? I mean, surely we would have been able to go, if we could go to our Congress people who are supposed to be supervising these intelligence agencies and their activities, that might have been another way to do it. But, you know, sometimes it seems like, you know, some of those people on the committee have a rather incestuous relationship in the intelligence community, and it seems that they protect each other. I mean, we haven't had much progress there. So, the only thing that we could do maybe is to revive what we had back in the 1970s with the Church Committee and just have an investigation and bring these things to light.
Well, that was certainly anything that approaching the Church Committee would be a breath of fresh air. That was truly radical, was it not? In terms of what it was.
Yes, it was.
And it brought about these very intelligence oversight committees in the House and Senate that apparently not doing their job. So I guess we do need a reboot, right?
Looks like we need some major changes and major reforms. And, you know, hopefully this is a wake-up call to our government to enact these reforms and changes. before it's too late and before this does become a totalitarian state. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with that movie that came out a number of years ago called The Lives of Others.
Oh, yes. About, it's great movie about the Stasi,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful movie.
I would recommend... Yeah.
I was going to say, Elizabeth, unfortunately we've run out of time, but I appreciate that reference to that film, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Murray, who served as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East on the National Intelligence Council before retiring after a 27-year career in the U.S. government, where she specialized in Middle Eastern political and media analysis. She's a member of Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity and the Sam Adams Associates for Integrity in Intelligence. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking about the deadly intersection of mental illness and easy access to assault weapons.
Looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware, the South is yours. Oh, 1984. See, come see, remember me.
Yeah, you got it all night moving round.
You said it would last, but I guess we grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is John Donahue, a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Donahue.
Good to be with you.
And it looks as though, I mean, it looks as though I've looked like it from the beginning that the shooting at LAX, that the shooter had an issue with mental illness. The chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee said as much on Sunday. I was watching the news after it happened, and the first head of Homeland Security, the former governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge, came on and was obviously very upset and basically said, look, we as a nation are going to have to start thinking about the root causes of this, because this is going to happen time and time again. And we keep seeing these incidents and nothing is done about them. And while he was not specific, I assume that what he was talking about was the intersection between mental illness and the easy access to assault weapons in this country. And I guess if that's what indeed he was referring to, and I'm pretty sure that's what he was, it sort of brings you back to the NRA, doesn't it?
Yes, it's obviously something that the country has been kicking down the road rather than addressing, and I think it is important to start focusing on how these things happen and what we as a society will do to sort of address the problem, as opposed to just pretending it's not a real problem.
But in terms of the killing of a TSA officer, as this young fellow did, who was obviously influenced by, you know, some ridiculous conspiracy theories propagated by the Alex Joneses of the world, that somehow the TSA people are a part of some government conspiracy. What I find extraordinarily ironic about it, given that we willingly take our shoes off at airports and go through this screening because of a fear of terrorism, and we accept that ritual at airports, even though the threat of terrorism barely exists, and yet we as a nation can't handle the idea of placing any restrictions on guns, which kill thousands times more Americans every year than terrorists could ever do.
Yes, it's an anomaly that we are willing to take some great measures to reduce small risks and are not willing to take small measures to reduce great risks. But I do think that you know, there is the will among the people to address some of these, and what's required is something to initiate action on the part of the legislators who have unfortunately been very strongly influenced by NRA pressures.
Well, just to be specific about the statistics, John Donahue, in 2012, 15 Americans were killed in terrorist attacks. In the previous year, 32,000 Americans died from gun violence. So there you have the stark contrast. As a law professor, what is your understanding of impediments in terms of having better reporting on mental illness? Because the same gun that was used at Los Angeles Airport was the same gun that was used at Aurora, and the Aurora shooter had to plead insanity. What came out of that was an indication that the authorities at the college, he wasn't adequately treated there, and he also had problems with his parents, who in turn have problems reporting these things. I think the same is true of the Newtown killer as well. So how do you come up with a system where mentally ill people can be detected, assuming that you can get to the second part of it, which is preventing them from buying firearms, which is, of course, is what where the NRA is the main obstacle. But is there a way to have a system in this country that's fair to people and that doesn't take away their civil rights arbitrarily at the same time? Because it seems to me that the authorities at schools and particularly parents at home obviously reluctant to basically suggest that somebody is a danger to society.
Yes, it's a tough nut to crack, but we could do a lot better, and most other affluent countries do a lot better than the U.S. in this regard. I do think, if you look at some of the recent shootings, I think the Navy shipyard shooting in D.C. a short while ago was emblematic of this concern that there were a lot of people who knew that this gentleman had very serious mental illness problems, and yet nothing stood as an impediment to him purchasing very dangerous weaponry. And I think that we really need to move to a situation that as soon as significant evidence comes to the attention of relevant authorities, that information gets right into a database and blocks the ability to purchase guns. Of course, to make that really effective, one really needs to move to the universal background check system. And I just think that a lot of these problems could be tidied up if we moved in that direction. Now, of course, if you really wanted to get rid of them, you'd have to sort of follow the approach of Australia, which they took after a horrific mass shooting back in 1996, and they essentially banned all semi-automatic weapons, which did eliminate the mass shooting problem, which had been a significant one in Australia in the 16 years prior to the Port Arthur killings in 1996, and they've had zero mass shootings since they took these very aggressive gun control measures. Of course, we have legal impediments that are greater, and of course a very obstructionist gun lobby that prevents more dramatic action, but there are things that are very reasonable and mainstream and that have very widespread popular support, such as universal background checks and getting mental health information into the system immediately rather than wait until very serious criminal misconduct has occurred before any steps are taken to restrict access to guns.
And again, I'm speaking with John Donahue, who is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. So just to buttress what you were just saying about the a Navy Yard shooter having a mental illness and demonstratively so, which other people, a number of people had detected, yet he was able to buy these lethal weapons. There have been 62 mass shootings in the United States since 1982, and three-quarters of the shooters have used legally obtained weapons. So that's the problem, and obviously the impediment to this is the NRA and the other gun lobbies. Senator Dianne Feinstein on Sunday, in reference to the shooting at Los Angeles International Airport, said it underscores the need for an assault weapons ban, but she said the NRA has a hammerlock on the Congress. So we keep having this conversation, John. I mean, you know what I mean? I'm sure you've had it 1,000 times, haven't you?
Yeah, it is troubling, and it is going to require the people to stand up. I mean, I do think one way in which the NRA is clever is that they're able to turn out the votes in off-year elections and special elections and punish those who oppose them, because they will turn out a large number of voters when the general electorate is less likely to turn out. So it is sort of incumbent upon the citizenry, who overwhelmingly favor common sense measures like universal background checks, to really assert their political power. As of now, the NRA has done an effective job of sort of marshaling the support of their very strong group of advocates to turn out for elections, and that gives the NRA outsized power. The NRA is actually a very small organization. The National Association of Retired Folks in this country, has 10 times as many members as the NRA. And so it shows you that if the AARP, just marshaled their forces, they could dwarf any electoral power of the NRA. But, of course, the NRA also is spreading their money around to politicians, and that carries some weight as well. But there are things that can be done that there is already overwhelming public support for, and the people are going to have to stand up to the NRA if those measures are going to be implemented.
But had this shooter, when he marched up to the TSA screener and pulled out this assault weapon and shot him several times and then was looking for TSA people, and he obviously was infected by this anti-government Alex Jones nonsense of these government agencies being somehow involved in totalitarian dark plans to take away our rights. But had he, for example, instead of saying TSA people are pigs or whatever his ridiculous delusion was, had he shouted Allah Akbar, we'd have more money pouring into the TSA, we'd have more anti-terrorism legislation passed, and millions more would be appropriated for Homeland Security. That's the part of it that I find extraordinary. You know, it's an open checkbook as far as terrorism is concerned, but it's a closed book as far as gun control is concerned.
Yeah, it has been disappointing, and it looked like after the Newtown shooting that some reasonable steps would be taken, but what that experience showed is that you have to move quickly because the NRA is effective at marshaling their forces when the public sort of loses some of their interest. The one thing that we know will happen, though, is that we will continue on this pace of, four or five serious mass shootings every year in the United States because the NRA has prevented reasonable steps to stop those. So the opportunity will come for the next one down the road before too long, because this is the nature of modern America. I should say that I agree with you that there has been very pernicious and dangerous anti-government rhetoric released by NRA forces and their sympathizers, which I think is to be condemned, because there are many marginal people and people with mental illness who hear that and unfortunately take it to heart. And, you know, this goes all the way back to Tim McVeigh, who was very much influenced by the extreme anti-government rhetoric, and who then felt no remorse about killing 168 people at the Oklahoma City federal building, because these were the tyrannical federal government agents. It is nonsense and dangerous to vilify people who are just trying to do their job as some sort of tyrannical force. Luckily, we live in a democracy, and if there are tyrannical figures, we're able to vote them out. And I wish the actions would be taken at the ballot box rather than in these insane ways that sometimes play out. But I do think the politicians who support that rhetoric should be called to task for essentially, if not encouraging, at least facilitating the misuse by people with mental illness concerns.
Well, I started out mentioning Tom Ridge, who sort of skirted around it. He was obviously upset, but he wasn't prepared to say what the real issues are. He said what you just said, that we're going to be seeing more of these incidents unless something is done. And so, you know, really, to my mind, it's people like the traditional Republicans, and not the Tea Party and the NRA types, but the more traditional Republicans like Tom Ridge, have really got to start laying it on the line and not mincing their words. I mean, if that's where the problem lies, and I imagine it's also true of the Democrats in rural counties as well, they're scared to death of the NRA.
Yeah, it's a serious concern that politicians have to contend with, and it really is going to require some concerted effort. Again, if the vast bulk of Americans who don't want to see these sorts of incidents were to exert their electoral muscle, they could crush the NRA. And it's really the fact that the American people loses interest fairly quickly while the NRA remains vigilant at the electoral level that allows them to have outsized influence on politicians. The politicians, while they are craven, they are responding to the incentives as they see them. And if the American public would stand up in a unified way, and overwhelmingly, the American public does not want these acts to occur, and realizes that reasonable steps can be made to curtail them, or at least minimize the risk of these occurring. We could take steps that would be beneficial.
Well, John Donahue, I thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, nice to chat.
Again, I've been speaking with John Donahue, who is a professor of law at Stanford Law School and a research associate at the National Bureau of Economic Research. He has written numerous publications on gun control policy and is the author of Shooting Down the More Guns, Less Crime Hypothesis. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the cruel and unusual cuts in food stamp assistance to over 47 million needy Americans.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jim Wild, president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund. and he litigated major law reform and class action cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, food stamps, and other public benefit issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jim Weil.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be on.
And obviously, it's a sad day. It started last Friday for many Americans. There are 47.6 million people receiving food stamps, and the cuts have begun last Friday, and they will increase over the years unless something is done about it. So let's get into the weeds here if we have to, but it's worth finding out. How did this come about? I understand it's not entirely to do with mean-spirited Republicans, that also the Democrats dropped the ball.
Well, I think that's fair, and there are really two things happening. One is this cut that's effective November 1st, which I'll come back to in a second, and the other is proposed further cuts being considered in Congress, especially driven by the conservatives in the House of Representatives, and those haven't been enacted yet, so those are far from inevitable. But the November 1st cuts are bad enough. What happened is in the 2009 Recovery Act, there was that included a important temporary boost in monthly food stamp benefits for everybody in the program. Important not just because it was important to the recovery, but because normally food stamp benefits aren't enough to get families through the month. And with this boost, it got closer to getting families through the month. And it was a temporary boost. It was supposed to end, but Congress decided to end it sooner, a couple years sooner than it otherwise was scheduled to end. So basically the last 2+ years of benefiting from this boost ended as of November 1st due to legislation from a couple years ago that did get Democratic as well as Republican support.
But in terms of the premise, which is that the deficit is the greatest threat to the United States, even though it's going down at record speed, that seems to be the excuse or the reason here. But it doesn't make any sense on the surface, because for every $1 in food stamps, you have 1.70. That's, you have $1.70 in economic activity that's generated. So who's making the – I mean, if the moral arguments don't work, how about the practical ones?
Right. Well, that's right. Both the moral and the practical arguments are overwhelming, but even overwhelming arguments sometimes don't work in a political system that's driven by more upscale voters and campaign donors. It's true that food stamps are considered essentially the single best economic stimulus, and that's because the people receiving food stamps, now called SNAP, of course, or in California, CalFresh, people receiving those benefits are so needy that they spend them very quickly, so it circulates in the economy very quickly and creates jobs and growth. And so reducing food stamp benefits harms growth. So something from J.P. Morgan that said these cuts will reduce growth over the next quarter by 0.2% of the gross national product. Well, 0.2% doesn't sound like a huge amount, but the economy is only growing at 2% a year, so 0.2% is a tenth of the growth just got knocked off by the food stamp cut, and that's many billions of dollars. So it's just ridiculous from an economic point of view. It's ridiculous from a health point of view, because cutting food stamp benefits makes children's and adult health worse. It's ridiculous if you care about poverty and hunger in this country, and it's ridiculous from a moral point of view. Pretty much any point of view you look at it, it's ridiculous. It does reduce the deficit, but reducing the deficit by harming low-income people is a really dumb way to reduce the deficit, although it often seems to be the only default way that deficit reduction happens when members of Congress get together.
But the deficit is being reduced to the equivalent of what, if you just canceled a couple of F-35 fighters that are a complete turkey, that don't work and cost billions each, I mean, there's no proportionality here in terms of affecting people that really are hurting to begin with. And as you pointed out, Jim Weil, that these food stamp benefits don't usually last the month with families. And a family of four, they're going to see their benefits shrink $36 to $632 a month for a family of four. And that means that, you know, it's a drop of $1.40 per meal. And they're already, you know, stretching the budget with lots of pasta and hamburger helper, et cetera. And that has impacts on obesity and childhood nutrition, et cetera. So it's just there's such a horrible chain reaction going on here over chump change in terms of the whole federal government.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the deficit's coming down fast. A lot of the deficit mania isn't justified. The nation may have deficit problems over the long term, really doesn't have them over the short term. And even over the long term, you know, this nation's fundamental problem, given how huge our economy is and how high our per capita income is, although it's not distributed well, certainly, the nation's real problem is managing abundance, not managing scarcity. But our politics seem to be about managing scarcity. We need to change the psychology of that. And there is a danger in the short run in this budget negotiation that's going on with the December deadline, where a lot of members in Congress on both the liberal and conservative side want to understandably end the sequester, but the conservatives in particular want to end the sequester, which is the across-the-board cut insofar as it affects defense, that this new round of food stamp reductions may be put out there by conservatives as one way to pay for boosting the defense budget and having less of a cut in the defense budget. So there's this constant threat to food stamp programs from members of Congress who don't care about low-income people and don't care about these crucial and very effective low-income programs, who keep making up attacks on the programs, even though there are huge numbers of people in their districts who really need these programs as well, who need food stamps and the Earned Income Tax Credit and Medicaid and programs like that. That poverty is not concentrated in 100 congressional districts. It's everywhere in the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Jim Weil, president of Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund, and he's litigated major law reform and class action cases in the federal courts of appeals and Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFTC, food stamps, and other public benefit issues. Now, when you talk about cutting, the Republicans want to cut food stamps in order to preserve or restore military spending and cut in the sequester. That sounds as if we're talking about, again, things like the F-35 fighter. When you have the military.com, the website that serves the armed forces community, reporting that nearly a million veterans and 5,000 active duty troops have been affected by these cuts in food stamps, that the fighting men and women and their families depend upon food stamps. So there, to me, is just an obscenity. You know, if they want to choose between the F-35 flying turkey and the food for active duty military and veterans, that ought to become the issue. I mean, what's happening on the Hill in terms of arguments, both on the moral and practical level?
Well, you know, I think the problems in Congress are worse than they were, but these aren't new problems in terms of conflicts between programs that are important to low-income people and programs that are important to others. The food stamp debate is also caught up with farm subsidies, and a lot of farm subsidies are programs that were bad ideas to start with or have or outlive their usefulness. So it's not just military spending where there's room to have savings. There are other places, too. But fundamentally, We have a problem in our politics of low-income people and increasing numbers of low-income people, many of whom are working at low-wage jobs, but their numbers are growing. And, of course, many of whom are jobless because the economy hasn't come back and the job creation that the government should be doing hasn't been happening. Growing numbers of low-income people struggling in a world where supports for them may be declining, shrinking, because members of Congress are looking to do other things, often because of campaign contributions from very wealthy donors whose contributions are unlimited because of the Citizens United decision. So you're right. I mean, there are real problems in the system in terms of allocating important government expenditures where they're most needed.
Well, the SNAP program, the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, otherwise known as food stamps, that's administered through the Department of Agriculture, also, of course, administered the farm subsidies. And one of the more egregious examples, of this lack of compassion, even though I think the biggest recipient of farm aid in the state of Tennessee, this Republican congressman, his family farm makes millions out of the government not to grow anything per year, he gets up on the floor and quotes the Bible, saying that he who does not work doesn't deserve to be fed, as if these people are indolent. So many of them are children. Isn't that the more unconscionable part of it? I mean, you've got 8.9 million families with children depending upon these payments, which average out at only $135 per month. And the current poverty level is $18,530 a year for a family of three. I defy most people to try and live on $18,000 a year.
Right. Just as an aside, the congressman you're talking about, Representative Stephen Fincher from Tennessee, whose family, he and his family have gotten several million dollars in farm subsidies over the last decade, although I don't think they're the biggest recipients of farm subsidies in Tennessee. But he's been one of the most outspoken proponents of cutting food stamps, quoting Jesus along the way. But somebody took a look at his home county, the county where he lives, and 20% of the people in that rural county, because poverty is as prevalent in rural areas as in metro areas in this country, 20% of the people in his home county receive food stamps. So again, that captures a congressman who's just totally unresponsive to the desperate need in his home district, in his home county, because he thinks less of the people receiving food stamps, or he thinks they're not going to vote, or whatever. And so his outspokenness about his religious belief that food stamps should be cut captures part of a significant part of the problem here.
Well, if it comes down to the priorities of Congress people, which are to raise money, and particularly from wealthy people, and under the current rules set by Citizens United, billionaires can give unlimited amounts of money without any attribution. So presumably they are seeking out those kind of people. But on the other side, given the impact on poor people in this congressman's county, I guess the sad fact is that he must be calculating that they're not going to vote. I mean, maybe they'd vote Democrat in any case, but is there, do you think there could be a backlash to get this guy out, which I think would be doing the Lord's work, frankly?
Yeah, and I don't know his district well enough to know whether it's possible. I do know that the polls show that a significant number of Republicans, not as many as Democrats, but a significant number of Republicans oppose cutting food stamps, and a more significant number of independents. So generally speaking, across the board, Americans oppose cutting food stamps, regardless of their race or ethnicity or gender or political party or region of the country. There are variations, but generally people oppose cutting food stamps. So the important thing is for constituents to say this is ridiculous, to write and email their members and say this is unacceptable. And they support this program. And if the members want to cut the deficit, believe they need to cut the deficit, they should find other better ways of doing it. But they don't want their members to cut food stamps.
Well, just in closing, Jim Wilde, the Senate has a less draconian bill, but even it cuts food stamps, doesn't it?
Right. So in addition to this November 1st across-the-board cut, that's going to be about $11 billion over the next couple of years, the phase-out of the temporary increase. Then as part of the so-called reauthorization, which really means every few years Congress takes a look at all the programs, the reauthorization of the Farm Bill, which includes food stamps, the House has passed a bill to cut food stamps by $40 billion, and the Senate has passed a bill to reduce food stamps by $4 billion. Those bills are in a conference committee. That conference committee does not have to pick a number between those numbers. It could pick a zero number. And our position is there should be no cuts in food stamps. People should reach out not just to their Republican members and say, don't cut $40 billion, don't use the House number. They should reach out to their Democratic members and say, food stamp cuts are unacceptable to me, even the $4 billion. And there are many, many members of both the House and the Senate who have taken the position publicly that any cuts are unacceptable. And the president, while we would encourage the president to be more outspoken about this, the president's budget has no food stamp cuts in it. Indeed, he's proposed restoring this November 1st across-the-board cut.
But at this point, the decks are stacked against the poor, the hungry, and the children in this country who depend upon this.
Sometimes it's an uphill battle, and I think both in terms of the job market and in terms of public supports, the deck's stacked against low-income people in this country, but there are ways to fight back, and we need to fight back.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian. It's a pleasure to be on.
Again, I've been speaking with Jim Wilde, who's the president of the Food Research and Action Center. Previously, he was program director and general counsel at the Children's Defense Fund, and he has litigated major law reform and class action cases in the Federal Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court on Social Security, Medicaid, AFDC, food stamps, and other public benefits issues. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasts at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared.